Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two segments today. First, in a couple of minutes, we'll hear from economist James Galbraith about what's in Greece's deal with its European masters, something he's been watching very closely. And at the bottom of the hour, the Chicago-based activist and organizer Kenzo Shibata will tell us what's behind the embarrassing showing by Mayor Rahm Emanuel in Tuesday's election. First, Greece. Early this week, the Greek government, in the person of frequent Behind the News guest turned finance minister Yanis Varoufakis, made proposals to what it's generously calling its European partners, something it had to do to unlock the financing it badly needs. All over the internet, ultra-leftists denounced the terms of the deal as a sellout, a capitulation, a betrayal by the young Syriza government. It is, of course, very easy to take that sort of position when you don't have 11 million people depending upon you to get it right when you go up against some very powerful adversaries. Greece is broke. It's in a very weak bargaining position against Germany, the IMF, and the European Central Bank. It has some big debt service payments due in the coming months with no money on hand and no way to borrow it without a seal of approval from European power centers. I wonder what the ultras expect, that by sheer strength of will the Syriza government could change all that? That it could conjure up money out of thin air? Some of that money-conjuring fantasy is present in the recommendation, popular in some circles, that Greece should just secede from the euro and revive the drachma, as if that wouldn't be massively disruptive, causing immense amounts of capital flight, chaos, and inflation. When you're short of real resources, printing fresh money can do no more than give you a temporary kick. It's very likely that returning to the drachma, or creating some parallel currency scheme in which pseudo-money were used for domestic transactions and euros for cross-border ones, would result in a very class-divided system, with elites sticking to euros and the masses stuck with depreciating drachmas or whatever. The terms of this deal are not pretty, but I don't see what the alternatives were. The arrangement borrows some time while the government concocts alternative strategies for the longer term. But don't just listen to me. Here is James Galbraith, an economist at the University of Texas, who's been close to the situation, serving as an informal advisor to the finance ministry in Athens. In the interview, we use the term primary surplus without defining it. It's the government's budgetary balance before interest payments expressed as a percentage of GDP. Under the terms of the bailout arrangement with the EU, and it should be emphasized that that bailout is mainly about providing funds to Greece's creditors, since that's where about 90% of the so-called aid that the country has received over the last 4 years has gone. Under the terms of that bailout, Greece was supposed to run a primary surplus of 4.5% of GDP this year, up from 1.5% last year. That's extremely tight for any country. It's insanely, excruciatingly tight for a country whose GDP is down 25%, which also happens to be the same number as the unemployment rate. Both the GDP decline and unemployment rate are comparable to the U.S. in 1932. Greece looks to be getting a break on that primary surplus, which should ease the fiscal squeeze on that sick economy. Okay, here's James Galbraith. The Greek government has made a proposal to its European masters. How would you characterize the content of this proposal?
Well, the Greek government has set out its program for reforms and its policy of government. And what has happened today is that the European partners, beginning with the three institutions, have said it's an acceptable basis for the start of negotiations.
And what's in the proposal?
A number of things. It's basically a reform program, but without the austerity elements that were economically disastrous and that had produced the political revolt that brought the Syriza government to power. So there's a great deal to do with tax administration, with dealing with tax evasion, anti-corruption measures, modernization of public administration, and some discussion of the issues that have been more contentious, including privatization and the labor law questions.
And the tax administration issue, a lot of that should not be controversial, should it? I mean, Greece has had a terrible record in that score.
No, it's not controversial. And in fact, there's reason to believe that this government will be more aggressive and effective than previous governments because it's not directly tied in or supported by the major tax evaders.
And I think the weeks before becoming finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis said something about how they were going to destroy the Greek oligarchy. What did he mean by that, and how's that being received?
I'm not in close contact with any of the Greek oligarchs, so I'm not quite sure how they are reacting at this point. But I think the crucial issues that really do have to do with tax arrears, tax evasion, and also possibly the implementation of a more effective property wealth tax.
What about distributional effects of these tax proposals? Do they look positive?
Well, what is being done here is to try to create some fiscal space to implement proposals to deal with the humanitarian crisis, which have to do with providing food, with providing power to people who are cut off and need heat in the wintertime, with other very basic measures, a little bit of strengthening public education, improving the access to health care. All of these things would be quite significant steps in dealing with the crisis in Greek society.
And there's nothing in these proposals that would be an obstacle to that?
No, I mean, not beyond the larger obstacle that the government simply doesn't have any money and has to raise money in order, has to get money in order to put money out. But that's a situation that would be the case whether they were in the program or not in the program.
Yeah, there are some people, more excitable people on the left, who say that that Greece has rolled over, that Syriza is becoming indistinguishable from Tony Blair's government. What do you say to that line of argument?
I don't think so. I mean, I was there in Brussels, and this is clearly a sea change in the way Europe is doing business. They have a government that was not cowed by enormous both political pressure and actually financial pressure, because the money was flowing out very rapidly from the Greek banks, and there was under the fear of the possibility that they might be forced to close or to limit withdrawals as early as today. And the government maintained its position, and I do not think there is another case of that, certainly in the Eurozone.
It seems to me that Greece is in a very, very difficult position negotiating. It's not negotiating from anything like a position of strength. What does it look like, you know, they've gotten out of this as coming from this position?
Well, that is true, and it's been true from the beginning. All of the heavy weapons were on the European side, and all the Greeks had going for them was the ability to say, no, there are limits beyond which we cannot go, to make that point credibly. That's certainly an old Greek tactic of burning your boats on the shores of Troy that did not have room to retreat. And on the European side, a recognition that there are larger questions in the future of the government of Spain, larger questions about the viability of the whole European project, and that ultimately the decision of the German government would have to be taken on that larger ground.
And what were the Europeans' weapons at this point? They could have cut off Greek financing and created an implosion in the Greek banking system?
Yeah, there are two things that they could have done. One is exactly that, and that would have forced the banks to close. And the other has to do with the short-term refinancing needs that the Greek government faces, which would have put them in the position of defaulting to the IMF, for example, which is absolutely off the table, something that no government wants to do.
The Greek government appears committed to staying within the euro and staying very much part of Europe, right? They're not looking to Grexit.
It has never been the program of Syriza to exit the euro, and Syriza was elected very much on the proposition that it has to be possible to achieve some change in European policy. You know, whether that proves to be the case is something that we now have an opportunity to find out over the next 4 months. But the significant thing here is that there has been opened up for the first time in the history of this crisis some actual space for discussion and negotiation between a member government and the European Union and the Eurozone, the European partners. In every previous instance, and particularly the case of France when François Hollande was elected, the government came in on a policy of, may have come in on a policy of, let's put an end to austerity, but having been read the Riot Act on the morning after the election, there was an about-face which produced a very deep, steep decline in the credibility and legitimacy of the government. That's not what has happened in Greece. The government has defined a defensible ground. It has stood that ground, and the Greek people are backing it. While Yanis Varoufakis was in Athens, was in Brussels, polls were coming out from Greece showing that about 80% of the Greek people supported the government's negotiating stance, which is, means almost half the people who voted against them are lending their support at this point.
And some of those excitable sorts I mentioned earlier are saying this is also rolling over to austerity. How does this document resist that?
Well, the document does not concede on the things like the cuts in the lowest level of the pensions. It doesn't concede on the minimum wage question. Put all of the public assets on the chopping block in a sort of assembly line fashion, as the previous program was pressing the government to do. So there are important areas where basically has now agreed that there shall be discussions about changing the direction of the policy. Those are steps in the right direction. At the same time, the Greek government, in the nature of things, doesn't have a lot of fiscal space. It has certainly moved away sharply from the unrealistic budget surplus target that was imposed in the previous program, which it was never going to meet anyway. But it would not be right to say that this is a carte blanche for anything like a major expansionary program, because there is no source of money for that unless investment can be spurred from the outside by the European Investment Bank, foreign direct investment, or from a better collection of delinquent or evaded taxes.
According to the IMF projections I saw earlier, they were projecting a 3% of GDP primary surplus this year. I believe the Greeks are proposing a 1.5%. Is that correct?
My understanding is that 1.5% was roughly what was achieved last year. This year, the target would be 1.5%, but recognizing that what's happened in the last 2 months makes that target already very difficult to achieve. Basically, since the over the election period, and given the way, to be frank about it, traps were set by the previous government and the way the negotiations were handled by the European partners, there's basically no activity in Greece in the last month or two. So there's no taxes coming in and, of course, a major outflow of funds from the bank. If the stabilizing moves that will happen now, March 5th, when the ECB meets, they may take a strong step to restore the liquidity of basically the sense of stability of the banking system. Maybe those tax revenues will start coming back in, but even getting to 1.5 at this point is going to be highly problematic given what's happened just in the last few weeks.
So we at least have an end to fiscal tightening, or further fiscal tightening, if not a reversal.
That's correct, yes.
It looks like this scheme is basically an attempt to buy time. What do you anticipate will happen over the next 4 months during the term of this agreement?
Well, two things. One is that on the ground, the government will have a chance to start implementing those policy measures which are outside of the scope of this agreement and not under any form of not under negotiation. And now, though some of those are quite significant in symbolic or substantive terms as well. Secondly, within the framework of these financial discussions, they will be able to get past some immediate financing obligations, debt repayments that have to be made, and they will be able to have a discussion with the partner institutions over the specific terms of an ongoing arrangement. And presumably, now that the scope for discussion is opened, and you get the impression, actually, that the partner institutions are not inflexible once they've been given the remit to have a discussion. There's a reasonable basis for hoping that that may go reasonably smoothly. What was going on, I think, in the last 8 days was, to a very substantial extent, a process of discovery in which, as one might expect, the German government and some of the other governments pushed hard as constituencies, and that there was no alternative to the existing program. Well, they didn't succeed. The government didn't fail. It didn't buckle. And so now we are we're now getting down to discuss the details of the changes in policy. And the sense that I have is that on the basis of sort of reasoned discussion on the merits, this is not going to be as difficult as getting to the point of opening the discussions has been. I could be wrong about that, but that's my instinct.
What is your sense of what Germany wants out of this?
Germany wants to maintain its position of control over the general direction of policy of the Eurozone, and it doesn't want to have a political revolution that spreads across all of the crisis countries. Germany may well be disappointed over the next year in terms of what's likely to happen, because that revolution has been sparked, there's no sign that it's going to reverse at this point.
I'm speaking with James Galbraith, an economist at the University of Texas, who's been advising the Syriza government in Athens. Yeah, do you see any signs of a budding alliance on the Euro periphery?
Well, that will depend upon the outcome of elections, of which the next one is in Spain.
And you have Podemos, which is in the first place now, and a new political force, as Syriza was just a few years ago. And it was obvious that the Spanish government was the one that was the most desperately opposed to concessions to Greece, and for reasons that obviously had nothing to do with Greece and everything to do with Spain. Similarly, there are something, I don't know the political situation in Finland nearly as well, but their Finnish government was upset for the same reasons. The Portuguese government is facing an election a little bit later on, and then there's the Irish government down the road. Ireland is a little bit different from the other three and took a softer line because it's not clear the government might well, the incumbent government might well benefit from an easier European policy. But certainly in the Spanish case, they're locked into a hard line. If it becomes clear that there really is an alternative, then the political foundation of the existing Spanish government could begin to decline quite quickly.
What kind of role, if any, has the European Central Bank been playing in these negotiations?
That's harder for me to judge. I haven't had any direct sense of the European Central Bank's role. They have been playing a pressure game from the outside by raising the limits on the emergency liquidity assistance by a little bit at a time, which served on a day-to-day basis to remind people how fragile the Greek banking system was. But internally, I have less of a sense of what they actually contributed than I do for the IMF or for the European Commission, where there are specific things that where they were clearly attempting to play a constructive role. So it's quite interesting, actually, that the institutions formerly known as the Troika, in the discussions at the policy level, were quite instrumental in moving these discussions toward a successful resolution. The real difficulties came from the finance ministers of particular countries, and of course from the posture taken by Wolfgang Schäuble of Germany, who simply said there must not be any change, that you have to sign up to the existing program or basically you're out of it. And he maintained that position until the very end, at which point he receded from it. And that, of course, that was what set up the ultimate decision to go forward with discussions.
And just to underscore the point for the ultras in the audience, Schäuble did not get all he wanted, right?
Well, Schäuble played a hand that he was probably planning to play all along, which was to concede nothing until he had to concede something. And if you concede, you take one step back at the very end, then you don't have to take two steps back. I'm sure that was, at least, I'm, let's say, informed by very practiced observers that this is the way Wolfgang Schäuble and the German government have operated, that they are extremely tough in these negotiations, when they even taking positions that they recognize to be untenable, on the ground that when they have to back off of them, that sets up a situation where they back off as little as possible. And it has to be remembered right now that this is not necessarily an irrational thing from the standpoint of a constructive outcome, because the program has to be sold to the CDU-CSU, to the German conservative parties, and it has to be passed by the Bundestag. So being able to say that they were as tough as possible is absolutely essential to maintaining their credibility in their own political coalition. Europe is a very complicated situation, very complicated scene.
And over the longer term, what are Greece's financing needs, say, after this four-month period expires? Does it need to get foreign financing to keep body and soul together?
Greece has a lot of debt obligations that come due in 2015. After 2015, the situation is much easier up until 2022 or so, well past the mandate of the newly elected government. So if we can get through into next year, there's every prospect that the government will have, dealing with the practical problems of bringing the Greek economy and Greek society back to some level of health, and not simply with a constant set of negotiations over funding issues.
I noticed in the Varoufakis memorandum reference to a minimum income. What's the story of that?
I don't know. I saw that reference as well, and I don't have the details.
And then more broadly, Greece's debt service burden, even though the gross debt looks very high, its actual debt service burden is not onerous by international standards. This really is about fighting austerity, isn't it? More than restructuring the debt, at least in the short term.
That is correct. It's about getting some policy changes that will be constructive for Greek society and getting some impetus for economic expansion into the economy, fighting austerity. So they have to find funding. If they can find funding, they can expand activity. Those are the that's the basic parameters with which we're dealing at this time.
But the fight against austerity really is a continent-wide fight, isn't it?
It will have to become so, yes. But it's possible that you could get a real change in the European climate over the next year. But if you think about a new government in Spain, well, then you have Spain and Greece on either side of the big player, which already has a center-left government. That's Italy. And the Italian government has not been trying to seek out major changes in European policy on its own, but in an environment where it has potentially two allies, both of them slightly to the left of Italy itself, then the Renzi government, which is really politically quite strong, I think, at this time, becomes a much more critical player than it has been, central player in the drama.
Germany has been running a very tight ship. It's kept a lid on wages, even though productivity has been rising, running a huge current account surplus, tight fiscal policy. Can there be any solution to the European crisis if Germany doesn't loosen up some?
That's an interesting question. And the answer to that is I think it is possible to have a improved performance in Europe without necessarily having a substantial change in policy in Germany. And the way to do that has been along the lines of the Modest Proposal, which is a document that Yanis Varoufakis and Stuart Holland and I co-authored various versions in recent years. And those would involve basically getting an investment program going in the crisis countries and a, let's say, Europe-supported program to provide humanitarian assistance and stabilize incomes at the household level, as well as bank resolution and dealing with the debt with national debts where they need to be dealt with. If you did those things, you would not be in the position of having to rely on Germany suddenly having a complete change of economic policy and becoming a kind of Keynesian locomotive for the European Union.
And then finally, there have been some proposals floating around from mostly some folks in the far left that Greece should either leave the euro completely and go back to the drachma, or leave it halfway and use some sort of funny money for domestic use, create some IOU or a scrip arrangement or something like that. What do you think of those proposals?
A parallel currency arrangement runs into difficulties with the European Central Bank. So thinking about how to get liquidity into the Greek system has to be done extremely carefully with that in mind. I'm not sure there is no intermediate solution of that type which is available, at least along the lines that I've seen discussed so far. The question of leaving the euro has not been on the agenda of the government because of the Greek public is overwhelmingly opposed to it, and because the effort to do so would be extraordinarily disruptive. You would have all kinds of questions about who gets paid in the new currency, and divisions that would open up as a result of changes in the value of that currency. It's something which has not been thought through carefully, I think, by those who advocate it. There's certainly not a carefully thought through plan to make it happen. So the idea that this was something that could happen in the early days of the new government was, I think, really very, it was, would have been taking enormous risks. The Greek position was that if they were going to be forced to that step, they would have to be forced, as I think I said earlier, by the Germans. The Germans at the end of the day, realized that was a step that they would be they didn't want to take responsibility for, and quite rightly, because who knows what the final outcome for Europe would be once you have a first government that leaves. Of course, it becomes possible for other governments also to leave, and who knows where it goes. I've often said, that there's I don't think there are any examples of large political entities that survived the departure of their smaller members, of their smallest members. Soviet Union didn't survive the departure of the Baltics. Yugoslavia didn't survive the departure of Slovenia. And the United States of America didn't survive the departure of South Carolina in 1860. It took a rather substantial and extensive war to get it back.
It seems an awful lot of people want Syriza to solve a problem in a couple of weeks that's been years in the making.
That is, I think, been a bit of a problem, and one has to recognize in the finance ministry on Sunday, February 8th, when I arrived there, they were just setting up. When Yanis Varoufakis took over from the previous minister was there to present him with the keys to the office, and there were no computers and there were no documents in the finance minister's office. It had been cleaned out completely. So, yes, this is a... You can't get a government, particularly one which has never been in power before and which is changing the direction of the country, can't get it up and running in a matter of 4 or 5 days. The creation has occurred on that scale, but by, let's say, more powerful and more experienced hands than were available in Greece on the 26th of January.
That was James Galbraith, professor of economics at the LBJ School at the University of Texas. If it wasn't clear from the interview, I should say that he's quite friendly with Greek Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis. That doesn't undermine anything he said, but fairness dictates that I say that. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of Kronerg, ballet music for orchestra and magnetic tape by the Greek composer Yanis Xenakis, performed by the Basel Symphony Orchestra under Alexander Winterson. I should try to find some other Greek music, but Xenakis is so good. This piece was written in 1969, and as the composer said, it was meant to evoke, quote, the current youth movements of that time, and his vision of the imminent, quote, biological struggle between generations unfurling all over the planet, destroying existing political, social, urban, scientific, artistic, and ideological frameworks on a scale never before attempted by humanity, close quote. Well, we all know how that worked out, but let's hope that Greece is transforming our received frameworks as we speak. Next up is Kenzo Shibata. Shibata was formerly with the Chicago Teachers Union and is now with the Illinois Federation of Teachers. He's speaking here for the campaign for an elected representative school board, of which he is communications director, and not for the IFT. Earlier this week, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel got only 45% in the first round of elections in that city, forcing him into an embarrassing runoff with a second-place finisher, Jesus Chuy Garcia. Emanuel had lots of money and the President of the United States behind him, but that was not enough. And a non-binding referendum to take away mayoral control of the schools and turn them over to elected school boards, which Rahm staunchly opposed, got a near 90% yes vote. Here's Kenzo Shibata with more. Welcome, Kenzo. So Rahm Emanuel, perhaps bruised, but not finished. But what is responsible for his poor showing in the election?
Well, I think voters are just ready for people who are like them, representing them. You know, we saw that in the city council races. A lot of machine candidates who were year after year incumbents were actually forced into runoffs. We saw a number of CTU members, Chicago Teachers Union members, running for office and then make it into runoffs. People are just really tired of having edicts, you know, foisted upon them by the leaders. And, you know, if you look at, you know, the elected school board initiative, which was on the ballot, which Rahm opposed, 90% of voters voted for that, whereas he only got 45% of the vote in the election. So it shows that people do want democracy.
Oh, what can you tell us about his record? I think most people outside Chicago know that he has a fondness for four-letter words and flipping people the bird, but what is the substance of Rahm's record that he's running on?
Well, he closed 50 schools in Chicago in 2013. These were, he started out with a high number, over 100 schools he wanted to close, and, you know, so goes in negotiations. He whittled down to 50, you know, went out to the media and said, look, I got it down to 50. This is the bare minimum. And the rationale changed. Like, initially, he was saying the schools were underutilized and they needed to be closed and consolidated. And then over time, he started finding new rhetoric. He started calling them failing schools. And he just kind of tried to find ways to agitate people against their public schools, and it didn't work. This was, you know, the school closings campaign happened off the heels of the Chicago teacher strike of 2012, where we did see overwhelming community support for our schools. So Rahm definitely is not in line with, you know, where the voters are. And on top of that, he also closed mental health clinics in the city. It was a part of this doomsday budget that he, you know, forced upon this, rammed down the city council's throat, essentially, and which, you know, people who were depending on these mental health clinics, you know, low-income folks with problems, they were forced, you know, they were basically put back out in the street. And, you know, one of the leading activists actually in that cause said, you know, if you close, to Rahm Emanuel, if you close my clinic, I will die. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. So this is a guy who doesn't really care much about the interests of the average Joe in or Jane in Chicago. He's very much working for hedge fund interests, working for corporate interests, working for tech industry interests, and not in the interests of the rest of us.
And there are also some privatization scandals around his administration, too, weren't there?
There are a few, you know, points where he's moving to privatize, like the school closing campaign. To give you a little more detail about that, now they closed 50 schools, and now you have these schools that were overcrowded because there had to be receiving schools. There were students who were just kind of lost in the system, and you know the crisis, or the, I'm sorry, the opportunity that you know he had lying around, as he would say, were charter schools. So charter schools, they advertise, they spend a lot of money on advertising to the community, and they paint themselves as being this great alternative. And, you know, if you look at the physical plant of most of the charter schools, they are nicer. You know, they get a lot of capital funds from the state and from private investors to make these beautiful schools. So when your school is falling apart and you have 40 kids in the classroom, people might look past the fact that, you know, that they're are also walking away from, like, experienced teachers, for example, when they send their kid to a charter school. Charter schools have very high turnover rates. So it was kind of a whole system put in place to move students from the public schools into these charter schools. And these charter schools, the people who are granted the charters tend to have a lot of political clout. So it's really more of a system of trying to ensure his reelection by opening these charter schools, and it has anything to do with improving education.
Improving his chances of re-election by, making friends with the rich people?
Yeah.
That was pretty much his entire agenda, is making friends with the rich people, wasn't it?
Yeah, the interesting thing about the way Chicago runs right now is, you know, we used to have ward-level organizations. Not to say that that was good, but, you know, it was the Chicago machine, and you know, you'd have public workers doing electoral work. And that was a system like, you know, you needed to make the ward committeemen happy. and then possibly get some employment out of it. And it, as bad as that was, at least that kept the money in Chicago. You know, the patronage system was going through people, and even though there was limited access for most people to work their way up in the machine, you know, you could be driving a garbage truck one day, and if you make the right friends and get the right patrons, you can work your way up in the system. What Rahm Emanuel has in place is more of a neoliberal model, where he is carrying the message for and, you know, carrying the will of the 1%. And money for his campaign was coming outside of the city of Chicago. A lot of contracts were going to people outside of the city of Chicago. So you don't have that machine that we had before. We had this kind of neoliberal machine light that exists now. And I think the deterioration of the old school machine is partially the reason why we saw so many upsets in the council races.
On last week's show, we discussed some of Bruce Rauner's war on public employee unions. What is Rahm's relationship with Governor Rauner?
We know that the two of them are personal friends. Rauner is a member of this wine club that costs a minimum of $150,000 a year to be a member of. And, you know, Rahm also has proclivities towards these fancy wines. So there's this picture going around the internet of the two of them kind of walking through this very scenic, pastoral scene in wine country, just kind of smiling and walking. So the two of them are friends. There was a little bit of rhetoric from Rahm's part during right before the election, where he pushed back on some of the right-to-work initiatives that Rauner is trying to make happen in Illinois. But beyond that, the two have worked together.
And Rahm himself spent some time as a hedge fund guy, right?
Yes. That was like his foray into the private sector between public sector jobs, as he made millions. He made millions from the banks, essentially.
And he also is very close to the president, right?
Well, yeah, that was another thing that was really interesting about the election was the president was in town to dedicate the Pullman monument in Chicago, and this was kind of seen as being his approval of Rahm Emanuel, and the president is still very popular in Chicago, and people thought this was going to be a huge boon for him, but it didn't really end up being that.
Chicago has a nonpartisan mayoral race, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that happened. It's interesting. In 94, when, you know, the whole Newt Gingrich, the Contract on America, was pushing through in national politics, a lot of state governments also turned over to Republicans, to Republican majorities in that time, because Republicans were going out to vote. They were being agitated by Gingrich. They were, you know, ready to go out and, you know, push back on Clinton, on Bill Clinton. So we had this Republican General Assembly that year, and they pushed through a lot of reforms that only affected Chicago, and one of them was moving elections to a nonpartisan one. And the other thing was one of the big things that they also did was that was when they gave the mayor of Chicago power over the schools.
Okay, and I want to get to the school issue in a second, but Rahm came in first but didn't get 50% of the vote, so there has to be a runoff right now. Who is the number two person?
Jesus Chuy Garcia. He's currently a Cook County commissioner in Chicago. He was also a state senator, an alderman. He's really a mainstay in Southwest Side politics in Chicago. Very progressive, very down to earth. And he entered the race, and there was a lot of just energy around it. Even though Rahm outspent him by like a ridiculous amount, just, there was a total of $10 million spent by Rahm compared to Garcia, who raised only $1.3 million total. You know, it was extremely close, all things considered.
Yeah, so when is the final election going to be then?
April 7th. April 7th will be the runoff election, where the two will face each other, and also all the runoffs in the city council will be determined.
So I'm guessing the rich and powerful are going to be mobilizing in Rahm's behalf after this surprise showing.
Yeah, I think that's safe to say.
I'm speaking with Kenzo Shibata, who is the communications director of the Campaign for an Elected Representative School Board in Chicago. The alderman elections, what was the body like going into this, and who won, who lost? How's the configuration going to change?
Well, the interesting thing, right now we have 50 members of the city council, 9 or so of which, the reason why I say or so is because that number kind of changes, are part of what's called the Progressive Caucus, and they're a bloc that, you know, believes in public schools, believes in public works, anti-privatization. So, of course, Rahm Emanuel has his own super PAC that's pushing against those efforts. So he's running people against these reformers. And the reformers, interestingly, a lot of them are just regular folks who've never been involved in electoral politics before. One particular race that I thought was interesting was in the 33rd Ward, which was ruled over by Dick Mell for years. He's the ward committee. He still is actually the ward committeeman, and was an extremely powerful alderman. One of those people who would never be voted out of office. Well, he retired a couple of years ago, and he appointed his daughter to his seat, who was at the time a state representative, Deborah Mell, which, you know, right off the bat, people saw that as being like her being crowned, essentially, and given over his throne. And interesting things about Mel was he was one of the Verdoli Act 29. Those were the 29 white members of city council who pushed back against everything that the Harold Washington Coalition was trying to do. You know, it was a time called the Council Wars, where it was absolutely ruthless and brutal the way that people were trying their hardest to make sure that Washington couldn't look good and couldn't actually do good things for the city. And this was, you know, Mel was a big player in that. Another interesting thing is that Mel's other daughter, Patty, is Patty Mel Blagojevich, who is doing electoral work on part of her sister, Deborah. So, you know, her opponent was this guy, Tim Meegan, who's a high school teacher at Roosevelt High School and really strong unionist. I met him during the CTU strike. He did not run as a Democrat. He ran as an independent. And he had a great ground game. He just had a very energetic young staff. He had people, like, just in the neighborhoods. You saw his signs everywhere. You know, as soon as the signs were being pulled up by the incumbents' camp, you know, they were putting them right back down into the ground. There was a lot of energy around that. And he actually was able to force her into a runoff.
So what's the effect been of the Chicago Teachers Union strike a couple of years ago? Has this had a lingering effect on Chicago politics?
Well, I think what it did many things. It changed the way people kind of perceived city government. It wasn't such a monolith that it was under the Daley years. I think people see the cracks in it, and they see the power in their neighbors coming together and fighting. Another very important piece is during the organizing of the strike, teachers became very organized in their schools and in their wards. Which, you know, made very fertile ground for the organizing that went around in these elections. So I think what it did was it gave people an opportunity to believe in themselves.
And then there was a challenge to mayoral control of the schools, right? What was that about?
Oh, well, yeah, the elected school board measure. Rahm Emanuel says that he's against the idea of an elected school board. Since 1995, the entire Chicago Board of Education is appointed by the mayor. And this basically means that these are people who are clouded in and are given the ability to make all the decisions for the schools. But, of course, you know, their patron is the mayor of Chicago, whoever that happens to be. So you see things like we have one member of the Board of Ed, Deborah Quazzo, whose companies hold contracts with the Chicago Public Schools to the tune of $2.9 million. And then she also has additional contracts with charter schools over $1 million. So she sits on a board that approves contracts that benefit her the company she owns. So it's a different kind of patronage than we had before. And I I felt like going into this, a lot of people didn't even realize that our board was appointed. And when we were out campaigning, when people were collecting petition signatures, you heard that from a lot of people. Like, wow, I didn't realize that's the reason why we're having all these problems in the schools, the fact that all the decisions are made by one person who has very narrow views. So in 2012, about 13% of precincts in Chicago voted, and 87% said yes to an elected school board. And we had another non-binding referendum on, in the 2015 ballot, which won by 89%. And that one was an uphill battle just to get that on ballots. There is a state law that only 3 ballot initiatives can be on the ballot at any given time. And Rahm's allies made sure that there were 3 issues that took precedence over the elected school board one. So within the wards, people had to collect petition signatures to get them on their ballot just for their ward. So 37 wards actually had, 37 out of 50 had it on the ballot yesterday, and 89% of people voted to approve an elected school board. Now, the problem with this is that it's non-binding. So the work still has to happen in our state capitol in Springfield, but now we have, you know, consistently our numbers are actually climbing in interest in having an elected school board.
Yeah, I was looking at the ward-by-ward returns earlier, and it's like, I don't think a ward voted less than 83% in favor of this. I mean, when do you ever see this sort of thing in politics, that kind of overwhelming support?
And, you know, interesting thing, too, about that is, you know, like I said, was saying earlier, people who voted for Rahm voted for Rahm, but also voted for a policy that he's against. So, you know, I think that a lot of this campaign going forward is just putting information out, like making sure people know what Rahm Emanuel is really about.
And so if this is a non-binding resolution, then what are the steps that that follow to make it a binding one?
Well, it's still it's going to be a typical lobbying effort where allies from the communities, I shouldn't actually say typical because there's going to be a lot of grassroots organizing around it as well. And there are some key people that in the legislature that we feel will support this, and we're going to work with them and our allies in the communities. And, you know, we have to basically convince the entire state, people from, you know, all the way south to the very north, that Chicago deserves an elected school board. So there's going to have to be a lot of education for these elected officials.
I'm guessing that a lot of people in Illinois outside Chicago view the city the same way that people outside New York City in New York State view the big city as a stink pot of corruption and with deep suspicion, right?
Then that's that was part of what fueled mayoral control in the first place, was that Mayor Daley said to the state representatives outside of Chicago, like, give me the responsibility, and then you don't have to hear about our schools anymore. And he really did play on that in those divisions.
Now, the agenda of having elected school boards, what's the aim of that? Is to reverse some of the privatization and charterization initiatives, or what's the substance of it?
Well, the overarching idea is to make these people accountable. Right now, they're accountable to no one but the mayor, who has this ridiculously high, big war chest that he can, you know, use towards re-elections. And having an elected representative school board, because part of this policy is going to make sure that the city is broken up into regional areas, so people from all the neighborhoods can have some voice in the matter. The idea behind that is, you know, if someone is bad, they can be voted out. You know, we can actually run people who we see in the grocery store every day for school board. Like, I often work in other districts, and sometimes, you know, during contract negotiations, it could even be a matter of someone running into a board member at the grocery store and saying, hey, you know, these are some issues that are important to me. You know, we don't have that in Chicago. There's definitely a huge division. There's like an ivory tower that the Board of Ed sits upon, and the rest of us just have to kind of take what they scraps they throw at us.
What work do you have ahead of you in the coming months as you approach the runoff?
Well, for the next 6 weeks, there's going to be just massive mobilizations. Rahm spent down a lot of his war chest during, you know, the first round of elections. So it does give Chewy a bit of an advantage now. It levels the playing field slightly, which is definitely another advantage for Chewy. And, you know, now he was able to speak to communities that maybe didn't know who he was at first. So definitely it's Garcia has a lot of advantages in his favor right now, and we just need to kind of keep up that momentum.
That was Kenzo Shibata, Communications Director of the Campaign for an Elected Representative School Board in Chicago. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this. Well, you know who this is. Till next week, bye.
Chicago, Chicago, that toddling town. Chicago, Chicago, I will show you around. I love it that you bottom dollar, you lose the blues in Chicago, Chicago, the town that Billy Sunday couldn't shut down. On State Street, that great street, I just want to say, they do things they don't do on Broadway. They have the time of their life. I saw a man, he danced with his wife in Chicago, Chicago, my hometown. Chicago, Chicago, that toddling town. Chicago, Chicago, I'll show you around. I love it that you bottom dollar, you lose the blues in Chicago, Chicago, the town that Billy Sunday could not shut down.